This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's turn now to our week in review and to talk about Boston's Olympic bid and the rest of the week's news, including all that excitement about a new governor in town. Dante Ramos is with us. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe and a regular with us here on Radio Boston. Hey, Dante, good to have you.
Hey, great to be here.
And with me in the studio is Renee Loth. She's the editor of Architecture Boston and a columnist at the Boston Globe. Renee, great to see you back.
Thank you.
So let's start off with the Olympics. We just heard some back and forth a moment ago on this issue. I'd like to ask both of you, should Boston host a modest Olympics game? Is it a good idea? Should Boston be in the Olympics business at all? Dante, the Boston Globe has editorialized in favor of it. What's your view?
I think there's a lot that we still need to see. At the press conference this morning, there was an emphasis on how preliminary the discussion is. I guess, you know, speaking personally for what I've seen so far, I'd call myself at most Olympics curious. I think there are some intangible advantages to having an Olympics. I think the math historically has not necessarily penciled out in a lot of other Olympics events in the past. But I think there's a lot of discussion that needs to happen at this point. There was a lot of talk this morning about public process, and there's a little bit of a tension between the kind of public process that we get used to here in Boston, you know, including on things as small as, you know, housing developments with 5 or 6 housing units. You know, we have months of negotiations about that. And then the kind of broad strokes thinking that an Olympics requires. And that's already on display. And I think, you know, if nothing else, it'll be a great Full Employment Act for journalists to follow for these next couple of years.
I was going to say, someone in the newsroom last night, I think it was at the end of the day and people were tired, and a particular journalist who will go unnamed said, oh, great, now we've got to cover this story for the next 2 years. Anyway, I think it's going to be a really interesting story. But Renee, you've been critical of the idea of Olympics in Boston.
Yeah, you know, I hate to rain on the Olympic torch here on this day of days, you know, where everyone is so excited about, you know, making this first cut. But I really believe it's a bad bet for Boston. I think, you know, first of all, I think it's unlikely, and maybe this is my hope over experience here, but I think it's unlikely that Boston will ultimately be chosen, because the International Olympics Committee has rarely, of late anyway, chosen U.S. cities. They've been tending to focus more on international venues and the developing world, in particular Rio and, and so on. And so I think it's unlikely anyway that we'll be chosen. And then in the meantime, we're going to be spending millions of dollars on this bid, you know, preparing for it, wining and dining the committees, you know, preparing plans and studies and reports. And Chicago, to its, you know, disappointment, spent $100 million just for the privilege of losing the Olympics bid. So I think, you know, your critic earlier spoke about the opportunity costs, that things that are not addressed while we're, you know, chasing the gold. And I think there's a, you know, a money opportunity cost as well, which is, you know, how else better can we spend even $100 million, much less several billion if we do make the cut.
But what about the argument, and I'll just put it out there just because it's not being voiced with any sort of gusto or enthusiasm here, but we had Mike Ross on the show recently, the former city councilor, former candidate for mayor, and he said, look, this is great for the city of Boston. This is like what happens to your house when you're preparing a nice dinner party. You make everything nice, and we're going to do all these great infrastructure improvements. You know, the Green Line's going to get better. Everything's going to sort of get spit polished and updated. What about that, Dante? Isn't that a reason to at least pursue this for a while, for as long as Boston can?
I happen to agree with Mike Ross on that point. You heard Chris Dempsey mentioning, if there was Chris Dempsey, the co-founder of No Boston Olympics, right, saying that if there were a 2030 plan, then they would be right behind it. There's not a shortage of long-term strategic plans gathering dust on various shelves. I think Mike Ross is right to argue that having a hard deadline will lead to a lot of, it basically forces you to make certain decisions. It basically forces a deadline for some of the long, drawn-out negotiations and public discussions that we tend to have. The counterargument, of course, is that in the rush to make certain decisions or to make certain things happen, you end up agreeing to things that you wouldn't necessarily agree to in the abstract, and that something, the cost of something that start out at $4.5 billion ends up doubling to twice that or being a multiple of that, and all of a sudden you're far enough along in the discussion that you can't get out of it. I personally think there is some value, though, to having a deadline on these sort of civic discussions.
Yeah, I think it's kind of sad to suggest that Boston needs this kind of spur to have the kind of public debate that we should be having on questions around, you know, how we're finally going to fix our transportation, you know, gridlock problems and infrastructure issues. I do think that's probably the strongest argument that the proponents have, that this will provide the catalyst for this kind of, you know, robust public discussion. But we haven't seen it yet. In fact, you know, I just learned for the first time on this show that supposedly 75% of the venues will be existing facilities, as John Fish said at the press conference, because that entire process has been held in secret. Mm. No one has seen the Olympics bid except for the people on the committee. The governor hasn't even seen it. The mayor hasn't seen it. So I'm not entirely confident that this is going to be the, you know, great transparent public discussion that the mayor promises.
Well, that'll be certainly something that we'll pay attention to going forward. Let's move on, talk about the other big news of the week. And usually our week in review focuses pretty closely on local news, but I want to bring up this awful story in France, the massacre of 12 people at the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris. There may have been several more deaths in the ensuing efforts to capture the terrorists behind that attack. The latest news is this: two brothers suspected of carrying out the killings and an alleged ally are dead, killed in two raids by French security forces, which freed some hostages but left at least four more people dead. So the brutal slaughter of journalists, the violent aftermath shocked the world. And here in Boston, it's hard to ignore the parallels to the attack on the Boston Marathon attack. The suspected killers are two brothers with ties to radical Islam, the murder of innocents, a cop executed, a day-long manhunt, a shootout, and the idea that Western cities like Boston and now Paris are not immune to this kind of thing. I've just been thinking about that. Renee, your thought? What have you been thinking about?
I mean, it does feel kind of emotionally similar because of the lockdown and the manhunt and, of course, the awful killings in the first instance. I think there are some differences, though. I think that, you know, the attack on the newspaper was, more of an overtly political act than the more random attack on the marathon spectators. I also think that the reactions, happily for us here in Boston so far, have been different. I mean, I've been very sad to see the rise of kind of, you know, neo-Nazi and far right-wing reaction to these unspeakable acts in France, you know, and I think here in Boston we were very much more, proportionate in our response that brought the city together. I'm afraid that in Europe, which has very deep schisms along these religious and social lines, I think that this may tear the city apart.
Mm. Dante, what's your view?
I tend to see some of the parallels that that Anthony mentioned. I mean, it does speak to that there's you see the schisms more pronounced in France and the social divisions more pronounced in France, but there is a common thread in both of these cases, is that you have immigrant communities or first generation children of immigrants who are somewhat alienated from the status quo, who are sufficiently involved or enmeshed in the society to see some of the vulnerabilities, but not enough to have internalized the full range of social values. And in some cases, that sense of alienation leads to people taking interest in more radical sentiments. It's hard to know exactly what to do about it. I mean, I think that the response in Boston, which was to be more embracing and to be more inclusive, is something that you'd like to see happen around the world. And seeing a kind of aggressive or fearful reaction as opposed to a renewed commitment to assimilate new people is something that I think could lead to bad results.
Sure. Well, it's just a horrendous, horrendous story. And we'll move on to a more hopeful one, the inauguration of a new governor. Yesterday, Charlie Baker took the oath of office and became the state's 72nd governor.
The time has come to write the next great chapter in the history of this great Commonwealth.
So in his first speech as governor, Baker promised to tackle a growing budget deficit, homelessness, opiate addiction, and to make Massachusetts state government more efficient, more transparent. And he struck a decidedly bipartisan tone, evoking the names of two well-known Democrats, including John F. Kennedy and former Mayor Tom Menino.
He believed government was about high ideals, but he also equally believed that basic services mattered and that every detail counted. When people have to wait for hours to conduct a simple transaction at the registry, they're not being served. And when thousands of families continue to be confused and let down by the health connector, we're not paying attention to the details. Those are but two examples.
So, Renee, high ideals, but paying attention to the small details of government.
Yeah, well, that's the way that Charlie Baker ran for governor, as a manager, as a kind of, you know, Menino was the urban mechanic. I guess, you know, Baker's going to be the Massachusetts mechanic.
Right, the state mechanic.
And state mechanic. I think that, you know, that's a welcome you know, development. We have a lot of problems that he needs to dig down into. You know, the first being the, you know, immediate budget deficit, not to mention the one that might, you know, be facing us in the next fiscal year. I will say that I think this could be the perfect alignment of the man with the moment. And this is my hopeful side, because, you know, we are facing bad, you know, fiscal problems, and they are primarily due to the cost of health care. And here's a guy who really understands the mechanics of public health, how it works, where the bodies are buried, so to speak, you know, where the savings might be. And, you know, the health care is just, you know, gobbling up huge parts of the budget. It's on track to something like our costs are on track to something like double in, by 2020. Mm-hmm. And here's a man who may finally, at last, bring into rein in, you know, those healthcare spending problems that we've had in Massachusetts, you know, for at least the last decade or two.
Yeah, interesting. Dante, I mean, does this represent the perfect alignment of the man with moment? I mean, here's Charlie Baker with this, you know, former healthcare executive. He was the budget chief under Weld and Salucci. It seems like he does have the chops to take this on.
I think as a matter of substance, I agree with everything that Renee said. There's probably nobody who would have a background in terms of work experience or intellectual experience to deal with these issues more directly. The question just becomes whether Baker is able to work with the Democratic legislature in order to make that happen. Now, you did hear him strike some very bipartisan notes in his speech. In addition to Chris Christie there, he had the new Democratic governor of Rhode Island to wish him well. And it makes sense. I mean, it would be hard for a Republican governor, given the dearth of Republicans in Massachusetts, to run a very strong partisan campaign anyway. So I think the circumstances, both political and in terms of what the needs are, certainly argue for what Baker has promised to do. But like any new governor, he has to prove whether he can actually do it.
Sure. Well, let's talk about one of the first challenges he'll take on. And Renee, you made reference to this. He noted yesterday that one of his first actions will be to deal with a $500 million budget gap from the previous administration, he was eager to point out. And then he said this.
If we're honest with ourselves, we can't blame this deficit on a lack of revenue. We have to recognize that this is a spending problem. And that dealing with it now will make balancing next year's budget that much easier. We will hold the line on taxes. We're already demanding enough from our hardworking people.
So you heard someone in the audience there saying, blame it on the former governor. Charlie Baker didn't respond to that, to his credit. But he pledged not to raise taxes and fees, so this could likely require cuts in services and some difficult negotiations with Beacon Hill Democrats. How do you think he'll do on that score, Dante?
It's funny, the blaming it on the former governor, notwithstanding Baker's refusal to take the bait, certainly is a...
I think that was planted.
Time-worn tactic of incoming governors. And, you know, it's a bit of expectation management. The big question becomes whether, you know, one of the things that Baker said in his speech was that, you know, the sort of usual tropes about not kicking the can down the road and dealing with problems now. In almost every budget, by almost every single governor, there's always an element of scotch tape and duct tape that's involved in putting the budget together. And it would be a little bit surprising if he were able to, you know, in broad strokes, completely remake the structure of the way state government is funded. There's a tendency to fund existing programs when people are fairly happy with the way they've been going, roughly in the way that they were funded last year. So I think it would be a little bit surprising to see him completely solve the deficit that ends up being what he described in the way that he described.
Mm. Well, let me ask you both about this finally. He's almost filled out his cabinet. Very bipartisan look. It's a mix of Democrats and Republicans. Jay Ash at Housing is a Democrat. Matt Beaton at Energy is a Republican. Ronald Walker at Labor is a Democrat. James Pizer in Education, a Republican. And the governor's chief of staff is Democrat Stephen Kadish. Your view on this, Renee, impressive so far, this team?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of bench, in the governor's cabinet, and I think he'll be, wanting to draw from them. I just think that despite the bipartisan nature of the speech and of the cabinet he's assembled and of the, reality, the necessity to be bipartisan in a Democratic state, there's also the ideological Charlie Baker, and we saw a little bit of that in the speech and in the way he's already been addressing this budget deficit, which is going to be the first thing, and first impressions are lasting, be the first thing that he addresses. He said he's not going to raise taxes, he's not going to go after local aid, it's not a revenue problem. Well, he's sort of setting up some pretty high expectations for himself. Dante mentioned the expectation game. He's setting up some pretty high expectations for himself to be able to manage his way out of this very serious problem where, other people have failed.
Sure. Well, let's talk very briefly about Cape Wind, that massive and controversial offshore wind farm plan for Nantucket Sound. This week, two power companies, National Grid and Northeast Utilities, pulled out of their contracts to buy electricity from the project. They say Cape Wind missed a deadline to finalize funding and to start building. So this is a huge setback for Cape Wind. Dante, what's your view on this? Is this it for Cape Wind?
It would be difficult for them to come back from that. As I understand it, these long-term contracts with utilities are important for certain types of offshore projects that haven't quite proven themselves in order for them to be able to get financing. And Cape Wind has struggled to be able to get the money that they need. What's concerning about it, in a way, is that Cape Wind is right in saying that the series of lawsuits and legal actions by opponents of the project are what kept them from really getting it together. They needed a lot to go right, and they hadn't, and it really didn't. It does become a little bit of a manual in a way for people who want to prevent something that's a new initiative from happening to for the kind of legal actions or tactics that they can pursue to stop it.
Yeah, no question that the opposition was relentless and very well funded. Renee, what's your view on the possible demise of Cape Wind?
Yeah, I agree that it's a big setback for Cape Wind and a kind of heckler's veto, if you want to call it that, where the opposition really has succeeded in derailing this process enough so that these important utility contracts have now been broken. But, the Cape Wind is still, I think, trying to say that this was, that they have a little out in their contract
right.
called force majeure, where they're able to say that, unprecedented actions have allowed them to extend some of their deadlines. Those are usually acts of God, tsunamis and so on, not necessarily, public opposition to the project. So, they might have done a better job, I think, of lining up their support before, diving into this. I don't know if they expected there to be quite the opposition that there was. And, we on the editorial page of the Boston Globe supported this proposal and probably still do. But I myself didn't quite, I think I underestimated, and so did they, apparently, the opposition.
All right. Well, we have just enough time for our hubbubs, those stories that fell below the fold but caught the imagination of our panelists. Renee, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, you know, as Dante knows, I just came back from 3 weeks in Australia, mate. And I was struck that, you know, with the start of the new year, some 20 states in the United States have raised their minimum wage, you know, through legislation or ballot questions, all the way up to $9.40 an hour in Washington State, which now has the highest. Whereas the federal minimum wage in the U.S. is $7.25. But in Australia, mate, the average, not the average, but the federal minimum wage is almost $17 an hour. And, you know, you have to not be surprised that young people are flocking there. It's a really dynamic and a diverse society. It's really, you sort of can't help but feel the energy. It might also have something to do with the fact that it's 82 degrees there.
Yeah, nice place to be in this season,
yeah,
no
or
question.
With the kangaroos, maybe.
All right. Dante, your hubbub.
Well, mine is closer to home. Mm. When the high-end grocery chain Whole Foods Market opened a new store on the former Boston Herald site this week, they were basically trolling generations of gritty, ink-stained Boston journalists. The Herald, of course, is a tabloid, a conservative tabloid that is not known for its patience with fussy yuppies. And so it's a little ironic that you can buy Chardonnay and heirloom tomatoes on the former Herald site. I will say the store also poses a competitive challenge to the current incarnation of the South End, which is full of boutique retailers. Mm-hmm. There's an in-store spa, and if they ever start selling $1,000 strollers or have a doggy daycare in the new Whole Foods store, you'll know the battle for the soul of the neighborhood is on.
All right. Well, here's my hubbub. It's about the selection of Pedro Martinez to the Hall of Fame, which was pretty great news. But you might not have heard from former Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling about why he didn't get a ticket to Cooperstown. And here's what he said on WEEI's Dennis and Callahan show. He suggested it was because he's a Republican.
I know that as a Republican, that there's some people that really don't like that.
But do you believe that if you were not politically outspoken, that you would have got, I don't know, 100 more votes yesterday?
Oh, I absolutely. I do know that there are guys who probably won't ever vote for me because of the things that I said or did, and, you know, that's the way it works.
So denied baseball immortality because of his political views. Now, in fairness, he did come back and say that was all in jest. And by the way, Schilling received 39% of the vote, barely half of the 75% needed to be enshrined. But there it is, the latest from Curt Schilling. Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe, and Dante Ramos, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you both, and have great weekends.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
And stay with us, folks. There's a lot more coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.